This is XTP Media.
They're more likely to get a cheap second-hand A380 than a third runway built overnight. So,
India's budget, annual budget now is around about $1.3-1.4 billion per year. That's for everything.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Takeoff. So, here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Pete Johnson, and welcome to episode 89 of Aerospace Radio Station, Extended. Now, I do apologise today. The sound quality has a few issues, one of which is some dental surgery I've had, so it sounds like I'm whistling through my teeth. I do apologise. I've also moved into a new recording area, and it's very empty, so if it's a bit echoey, do apologise about that. But let's crack on. Today, we've got Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society. Tim, it's been a while, but how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Thank you. Yep, looking forward to discussing all the aviation space news that we've got.
Yep, very exciting show lined up. Gareth can't be with us today, but he will be back on our next episode. Gurbir Singh holds a bachelor's degree in science, mathematics, physics and IT, as well as a bachelor of science in computing. He's the presenter and producer of Astro Talk UK, a not-for-profit astronomy and aerospace podcast, established in 2008 with a fabulous accompanying website. In 2011, he published his first book, Yuri Gagarin in London and Manchester. And 2 years ago, he published his second book, The Indian Space Programme, one of the most analytical and detailed reviews of the history of the journey of the Indian space sector that it's taken from its conception up to today. Gurbir holds a private pilot's licence for the US, the UK and Australia. Gurbir, welcome to Extended.
Good evening. Nice to be here.
Wow, great to have you on board. Great to have you on board. But before we go any further, tell me about your aviation exploits and your licenses for those three different continents.
Well, it's a very long time ago. my UK license was in 1990. I started learning here in the UK, but I live near Manchester, and you know all the sunshine and nice weather we have here.
Yeah, really, I was there on Friday. Yeah, it was raining.
Really made it difficult. So I actually took a month out and I went to Florida and I completed my training there. And then when I came back, I completed the examinations, and then I had both a UK and a US flying license, private pilot's light aircraft. And then in 1994, I used to be a teacher in those days. I used to work in a college, and I did something which is quite unusual and rare these days. I think it wasn't so much then. I did a job swap with a college lecturer in Tasmania, in Australia.
Wow.
And in addition to the jobs, we swapped houses and cars as well. Wow. And whilst I was out there, there was an airport nearby, and I did some more flying there. And of course, I had to recertificate for an Australian pilot's license. But I didn't really keep it up. So I've only done about 100 hours or so. But it was all very long time ago.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Sadly, I followed the same route. In fact, actually, I went to Florida as well. My claim to fame was that I got to fly down the runway at Kennedy. so at 1,000 feet. So there is a picture, there is evidence, but
when was that?
When a space shuttle was landing.
Yeah,
back since
I was flying just across the water a small airfield called Arthur Dunn, and if we were very nice to the traffic controllers, they would give us permission to fly down the runway. So that was a fascinating opportunity. Obviously, you can't do it now, but those were the days before 9/11, as they say. But yeah, interesting. Yeah.
So what year was that when you did that flight then?
Oh, dear mate, you've caught me out there. 90?
Right. Oh, 90. I did exactly the same thing. Wow. I was doing my training out of Titusville.
Yeah.
It was called International Space Airport or something like that. It was called those days.
2 or 3 miles away. How amazing.
Yeah.
I remember it well. Oh. I used to backseat with the pilots who were doing their twin engine licenses, because they just used to bash the hours out. And so they used to go to all the local airfields to do touch and goes, and that was one of them. So, small world.
Well, I have to share pictures. I've got a video somewhere.
I don't know about that. Anyway, on that point, let's crack on with today's episode, and let's have a look at some of the recent news stories that caught our eye. So, Tim, news of the last week or so, the A380 and the production is coming to an end. Sadly, on the 50th anniversary of the 747, we thought the A380 would go on, but it's not to be.
Yeah, what a week. So this hasn't just happened overnight. The writing on the wall has been on the wall for a while now, kind of rumours of will they or won't they, and really what they've been hanging on, really what Airbus has been hanging on for is an order by Emirates for about, I think it was about 36 aircraft, and there was other orders that got cancelled for it. Qantas cancelled. There was various sort of orders there in the order book that were sketchy at best, not very firm, and so Emirates has converted now to A330 Neos, A350s, and Airbus has decided that they're going to end production in 2021. So the A380 is going to keep on flying, you know, for a few years yet, but it was a big gamble that hasn't worked out, in that Airbus believed that people would need, you know, these super hubs, mega cities, people would need bigger and bigger airplanes, because you can't, you know, it's, as we see with Heathrow, it's very difficult to build extra concrete and put extra concrete down, build new airports. So they thought that, and what I think what the problem was is that the A380 came in just at the time when the big twins were getting longer and longer range and getting more and more fuel efficient, and there was a kind of a, well, not a step change, but maybe a step change in efficiency. And all of a sudden you've got, you know, 787, you've got the A350 that can come and do these long, really long haul routes, and they can go point to point. And yeah, you know, if you're booking a flight and the choice is, oh, well, you know, a couple of stops or, oh, well, go direct, you're 9 times out of 10 you'll take the direct route. You know, you want to get there and not stop off at anywhere else. So, yeah, shame, big shame for the
it was really popular, wasn't it, Tim? The A380, it was popular to fly.
Passengers love it. Love it. The problem is that airline accountants hate it.
Yeah,
and you've got four engines. You know, four engines, and you know, that's the last of the, well, the last of the, you know, the end of the aircraft you'd imagine would be bought for four engines, you know.
Yeah. And Will Horton on the Runway Girl Network wrote an interesting article around Cathay Pacific, who denied a lot about the A380, but one of the key reasons they didn't go was the lack of cargo space, which I never really thought of, actually, and also the big issue of an A380 being delayed into a hub, particularly in Asia, has a massive impact on the then spread of additional flights that those passengers come off of, and they genuinely believed that that risk was too great. I thought that was quite an interesting angle on it.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, at the time there was all the when Airbus were developing and brought it in, there was all the one of the things they had to do was try and convince the airlines, convince the airlines one thing, but also convince airports that, you know, you're going to have bigger departure lounges, you're going to have dual air bridges, you know, top deck, lower deck, you know, and put all this money into upgrading. And again, the problem is there's only a certain amount of routes that support the A380. You know, yeah. I mean, you know, you look at Heathrow is the busiest, one of the, you know, the busiest A380 hub on the planet. But for something like, you know, an American carriers haven't bought it. You know,
did you see what Simon Calder wrote in the Independent, Tim, about British Airways and the potential saviour for the A380? I mean, they've run their 747s, shall we say, long in the tooth, and will be running those for another 3 or 4 years. And there's a feeling they may be in the market to pick up additional A380s that are out there nice and cheaply because of that point you made about Heathrow. It is the A380 hub, and it's a great aircraft for BA on some of the North Atlantic routes in particular.
It could well be. I mean, they're more likely to get a cheap second-hand A380 than third runway built overnight. So
fair dues.
I can see that happening. I mean, I think Willie Walsh has been quoted that there's some along the lines of, you know, it needs a price reduction. So yeah, maybe second hand A380 would be, that's the way to go.
Right.
What do you think, Tim? You know, there is a global downturn in the economy right now. Is this necessarily the end of the A380? Could things pick up in the near future and maybe see it coming back again in a few years?
Well, that's an interesting one. I did get asked last week, was it the end of... I think they're going to phase production out in 2021. That means things have to turn around quite fast. You know, it'd be a bit ironic, wouldn't it, in about sort of, I don't know... 10 years time or eight, nine years time or something, when the cycle returns and all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, we'd really need a bigger airplane to take 800, 900, you know, why is it? And everyone's kind of looking around going, well, did Airbus keep the jigs for this? That said, I think, you know, it's going to have this is going to have put people off big airplanes for a while. I think where they might come back is something like blended wing body aircraft. So especially if those come in for, say, military variants first, you know, like a tanker or a transporter, and those have got, you know, massive internal volume. They're very, very efficient as well. And that way is where you might sort of see, well, yeah, that's where a big aeroplane, a big passenger airliner might come back, you know, something actually bigger than the A380. Some obviously things to solve with that, like you know, evacuation and virtual windows and things like that. But maybe 20 years down the line.
Oh well, what a shame. Let's move on to another story then. Let's start to get into our space topics. I picked up a story on Ars Technica, but it's been in the news everywhere, and this is about NASA going back to the moon. Jim Bridenstine said, we want to strike a balance between getting to the moon as fast as possible, whilst also, when we get to the moon, we're there to stay. This is the big vision. Now, gosh, I just, when I read that, I thought, is that because the Chinese have just landed on the other side of the moon? I've got to be honest, I didn't really see this coming. You know, we had the Gateway issue and we weren't going to go to the moon. NASA was just going to go to the Gateway. Where has all this immediacy come from?
I'll tell you, I'll share my view on Jim Bridenstine. I met him briefly at the International Aeronautical Congress in Bremen in October. He's a highly accomplished speaker. He was speaking along with all the heads of agencies, and he stood up miles ahead of everybody else in terms of communication. Now, he's very competent as well, but when he speaks, he makes everything sound really great and excellent. Now, I'm not saying you should dismiss what he's saying, but you know what the nature of space policy is. Yeah. You can have all the visions and ambitions until the cows come home, but you've really got to wait and to see how things really pan out. So it's great to hear that. You know, he's in a very senior role and what he says matters. But what actually NASA delivers, as you indicated, there's been problems with SLS and the Gateway already. We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, but they're putting money up for commercial organisations to look at landers, and I think it was 2027, 2028 to have humans back on the moon. It sort of become quite real, just very quickly. What's your view, Tim?
Well, I think possibly there is a bit of great power competition there with China getting the headlines. The problem obviously with SLS is, well, what does it do? You know,
well, it's got something to do now, hasn't it?
Yeah. So you know, there were only two missions actually sort of plugged in for it. So, and then also, what do you do with it? What's the Lunar Gateway for? Okay, yeah. It's going to orbit the moon and have sort of a way station. So possibly that, you know, after looking at mission proposals and you know, that was one of the things that popped into the, oh, well, actually this would, and we'll go out to industry. I think it was about sort of September last year where Lockheed Martin came through with a proposal for a new sort of lander and
yeah, that's and, right.
So
it's like the industry has pushed them to do this. Of course, you've got SpaceX and they've got the Falcon Heavy, of course. So that'll be an interesting battle. But they've also got their stainless steel Starship as well, which, of course, blew over in the wind the other day. Okay, I did feel for them. I do have to say, but interesting stainless steel, Gerbert. And why stainless steel?
Well, you know, one of the great unknowns right now, and why everything's moving so suddenly, all of a sudden, is because of the advent of the private sector. And whenever you get new players coming along, there's innovation. For stainless steel. It seems to, I'm sure they've done their due diligence and all their testing, it seems to solve all the problems. So why not go back in time and stick with traditional materials, which are shown to be working and are relatively cheap? So I think just the fact that it's stainless steel should not really be an issue. But there is going to be a lot more happening on the short term, and the space industry globally is going to be moving in unknown directions, not least because of what Elon Musk and SpaceX are doing, but also with Blue Origin and indeed the new entrants, the many new nations, and particularly China as well as the state-run space program. I think you'll see over the next 2 or 3 years the private sector in China stepping forward, and no idea at this point what kind of innovations they'll bring.
Yeah, interesting, interesting. And talking about innovations, we were just chatting before we hit record about Iridium Next. What's going on there, Gerber?
Well, I was really particularly interested by this. Iridium, as most astronomers know from their iridium flares, which are bright flashes from the antennas from these satellites, which generate very bright flashes in the night sky, and I understand can be seen in the daytime as well. So I've known about iridium for a long time, but this is a low Earth orbit constellation of communication satellites, which is really what's been providing satellite telephony for a long time. This month, the Iridium Next constellation came online. There were 66 satellites been launched since I think the program started of the Iridium Next in 2010, and it's taken about 8 launches from Falcon 9 to get these 66 satellites into low Earth orbit in, I think, 7 or 8 planes. And they're all operational now. And one of the payloads, hosted payload, it's called, is something that's called an automatic dependent surveillance broadcast, which is essentially a transmitter. I'm probably going to use old-fashioned term. Remember I remember in the very old Cessnas, they used to have these squawk boxes, so, which would transmit a signal. And what this device is doing is, if you have the appropriate box, a device in every aircraft, instead of relying on ground-based stations to plot the locations of the aircraft. And these ground stations are plentiful in inhabited areas, but over uninhabited areas and the poles, the seas and the oceans, there aren't any. So it's very difficult to track these aircraft over these remote locations. But these devices on the Iridium Next constellation allow aircraft to be tracked using satellites. And if a satellite is not over a ground station, it just passes that signal to another satellite, and maybe another satellite, until one is over a ground station. And then ground controllers get a full picture of all the aircraft anywhere, anytime around the globe. That's which is nice. Going to be a huge benefit, not only for safety and security, but possibly allow more efficient route planning, and potentially delivering a more efficient and cheaper service for all of us.
And no more disappearances like 370.
Well, this is a Malaysian Air. Airlines. I believe, although in principle you're right, but I understand on that particular flight somebody switched off the tracking device in the first place. So unless you have a device that's switched on, then obviously it won't work.
Fascinating. Well, let's leave the news there. Let's have a quick break and we'll come back and we'll talk about the Indian Space Agency.
Hello, I've got just a couple of minutes to tell you about our new edition, TAH-26, published on January the 15th. Our cover story concerns an important test pilot you've probably never heard of, Wing Commander James Adams. He was posted out to California on the eve of World War II, lucky man, to evaluate American aircraft for possible use by the Royal Air Force. So if you've ever wondered how come the RAF never adopted the P-38 Lightning, even though they did operate things like Mustangs and Thunderbolts, this article will explain why. Another major feature in TAH-26 completes the story of the RAF's Far East flight and its tour to Australia in 1927-28 in Supermarine Southampton flying boats. An extra treat in this article is our second ever double gatefold, a page that pulls out to three times its normal width, containing a beautiful contemporary map of the route, plus colourised images of the flight's team. The name Sidney Cotton may well be familiar to you, as the inventor of the Sidcot flying suit, and perhaps as a pioneer of clandestine photo reconnaissance at the start of World War II. We've previously run a story about his nefarious post-war gun-running activities in Pakistan. But in this issue, we go back to the early 1920s and his extraordinary venture in Newfoundland, where he was the first person to use aeroplanes to spot herds of seal during the annual seal hunt. It's a spine-tingling tale of hardship and determination against impossible odds. Elsewhere in TAH-26, we've got Convair's Tactical Sea Dart project. Yes, a waterborne, nuclear-capable strike jet concept, using hydro skis to take off and alight. We've got the commercial and political tussle between the Avro 748 and the Handley Page Dart Herald. Dassault's experimental jet prototypes, such as the Mystère de Nuit and the Barougon, a backseat ride in a Panavia Tornado, and lots more. Right, time's up. Now, remember, our journal is not on sale in newsagents, but you can order it online via our website, theaviationhistorian.com. Until next time, then, this is Mick Oakey talking exclusively to Extended.
Okay, we're back. So, Gerber, help us to understand the concept of the context of the Indian space sector in exploration today. How did it start, develop? Where did it come from?
Well, let me start off with what it's able to do right now. Of the around about 1,700 satellites that are operational in Earth orbit right now, there's about 50 of them which have been designed, built, and launched by India. And the Indian space program started way back in 1963, and gradually, with the help of many other nations, it's developed a ground infrastructure to build and design, test spacecraft. The very first satellite to go into Earth orbit was built in India was in 1975. The tracking and communication infrastructure has been growing. There is a huge 32-meter fully steerable satellite dish in just south of Bangalore, which is the heart of the Indian deep space network. There are several launch vehicles that India's developed, mostly with initially certainly with the help of France, with their liquid engines, the cryogenic engine was initially supported by Russia, but then the USSR. But when the USSR ended, that support also ended. So it has currently the Polar Satellite Launch Vehicle, or the PSLV, which has been operational since the early 1990s. It also has two variants in the GSLV, Mark II and Mark III. They use the third stage cryogenic engine. And only last year, the GSLV Mark III became operational following its second successful launch. There's also a talk about addressing the increasingly small satellite market with introducing a small satellite launch vehicle, an SSLV, which will put about a half a ton into low Earth orbit. It's also experimental, very early stages, but a reusable launch vehicle that India has tested once already, and it's planning to do another test probably earlier this year. And on top of all that, India had, way back in 2007, developed, launched a satellite, a spacecraft, was in Earth orbit for about 7 days, and then they deorbited it and it landed back in the Indian Ocean and it was recovered. It was the first time, that's 2007, that India launched something into space and recovered it off afterwards. And currently it's in a museum in South India. It's also placed a satellite, a science, it's had three science missions so far. One of them was, again, in 2008, and it was the very first science mission. It was a mission to the moon called Chandrayaan-1. And in my mind, it's probably the most successful of the science missions to date. And it was particularly successful because it was the very first one, and they really took some amazing shortcuts to get it launched. And they had... of the 11 instruments, six of them were not from India. So they came from France, Germany, one from Hungary, and of course, an American M3 instrument, which was responsible for making the landmark discovery of water on the surface of the moon. In 2015, India launched another space mission, science mission to Earth orbit space telescope. Now, most of it is multispectral, so it's infrared and ultraviolet, X-ray and gamma ray, but there is an optical telescope up there as well. It's in low Earth orbit and it's still functioning as it should, and it's produced a lot of data already. And then the other key thing that a lot of people heard about in 2013 was the launch of the very first spacecraft from India to go to Mars. The Mars Orbiter mission arrived there in 2014, and it's a very small vehicle. It's only got a payload of five instruments, and it was a technology demonstrator, and I think everybody was surprised, including India, that it has been remarkably successful. It was supposed to be operating for about 3 months, but even today, it's still operating.
I was going to say, it's still there, isn't it?
It was a first Mars mission, wasn't it? I think that succeeded on the first try.
That's right,
and also cost less than cost less than The Martian to make, wasn't it? the actual movie, it cost less. Going to Mars was actually cost less than making the film.
Really,
The Martian.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know where this yardstick of using Hollywood as a measuring rod came from, but you're dead right. And it was actually the Indian Prime Minister who, when it entered Martian orbit, used the example of the film Gravity, which had just been released just earlier that year, in 2014. But yes, it's been remarkably successful.
Just taking that point and quite seriously, just going into a bit of analysis on it, mm-hmm. One of the successes of the Indian space program is, of course, its cost base, which mm-hmm. is both a positive and a negative thing. Can you tell us a little bit about how they've managed to develop such sophisticated technology at such a low cost?
Whenever you talk about costs, it's always very difficult to actually come out with the real cost of space missions. I remember the BBC journalist Reg Turnill.
Yes.
He spent a lot of time covering the NASA Apollo missions. He's based himself out there after he'd worked on the Concorde mission way back in the 1960s. And he made the same comment about, how is it that you can actually come up with a final figure for space, because there are many aspects of, for example, the Apollo missions, particularly if you think about the security the various locations, the use of the U.S. Navy for recovery, and the medical facilities on the ground. He was saying that it's not quite clear if that's part of the calculation in the final figures. And in India's case, it's anything that's government-based is very difficult to iron out. However, going with the government figures, India's budget, annual budget now is around about $1.4 billion per year. That's for everything, including maintaining the operations of existing programs, as well as designing and building and launching new ones. However, I should just point out that the program for human spaceflight that was announced in August last year has a separate budget of almost $1.4 billion to achieve India's first human spaceflight by 2022. So that will be spread over about 3 years. But yes, it's partially, to answer your question, Peter, it's just the way that India's evolved. And I remember speaking to a former chairman of ISRO during my research, Professor U.R. Rao, one of the most delightful individuals, extremely well-informed and very competent persons who really was critical to my research. I asked him that question. I was sat in his office, and you know, this is just the nature of the economy in India. But also, he was saying, he said, and I'm only half joking when I say this, but they don't pay us enough. And what he was saying really was that the Indian engineers, if you compare them with the space engineers and scientists in ESA or NASA, do get only a fraction of the salary. And that's in part is the answer to your question, why they do it at such a low cost.
And what about the hardware and the software? How much of it is indigenous, and how's that been developed over the last sort of 30 or 40 years?
India was, I suppose, very canny when in the early days. I'll just mention a couple of names. The founder of the Indian Space Program is a guy who died in 1971 called Vikram Sarabhai. And he was high-energy particle physicist by training, but he also had the contacts through his family businesses to people in high society and indeed in government. So he came from a very well-off family, and he was given the responsibility in the early days of developing India's space program. And he was quite a focused individual. He realized that just a decade or so after independence, India was, if it was going to go along this route of developing a space program, which was way ahead of anything India had at the time, it had to do it in partnership with others. And what Vikram Sarabhai did was he roped, through his contacts and through the contacts of contacts, many people. And in particular, he used the then fairly new space agency, CNES in France, to help him develop the liquid engines which are used in the PSLV today. In fact, the very first launch of a rocket from India into space came from a declassified missile, an American rocket called the Nike Apache. Two separate rockets. And they were donated by NASA to India. And there was a ground radar that was support that was provided by Russia. The payload, so one of these sodium cloud payloads in that launch, came from France. And that kind of approach of using technology from other nations to get India going was the way that everything developed, including the cryogenic engine technology. In fact, one of the difficulties that India is having now with the human spaceflight program is that it has no experience whatsoever of human spaceflight. So it did a deal in October last year, just a few months after the announcement that they're going to proceed with a human spaceflight program. They signed a deal with when President Putin arrived in India for Russia to help with astronaut training. Not only is the expertise missing, but the facilities just aren't there in India as well. And I saw a reference by a report from the ISRO chairman saying that they actually might turn to France as well for some biomedical equipment and assessments as part of to support its human spaceflight program. So they're continuing now in the way that they started out, which is to lean on others at in the initial stages and then ensure that their long-term goal has always been to be self-sufficient. And that's what's happening here in human spaceflight too.
Can I ask a question on the so you know, India's, you've got launchers, you've got a mission to Mars, you know, and a manned spaceflight, and obviously these are done with some external help. But could you perhaps you might just sort of shed some light on what is a very successful Indian space program, and maybe a less successful indigenous Indian aviation sector? And I'm thinking here of things like, you know, sort of Tejas, the fighter, which has sort of taken, you know, decades, and various sort of, you know, kind of slow progress there. I think we'd say being charitable. Why is there such a difference, do you think, between the sort of the space and kind of aerospace sort of aviation sectors in getting that up and running?
It's a really good observation. I don't know the full answer, but let me give it a shot. It has been recognised by many of the people who work in the space sector in India that India's self-sufficiency in space is not copied over to the commercial space aviation sector, as you indicated. Indeed, it's also absent from the military. India's military is highly reliant on fighters and even tanks and missiles from other countries. Although on the missile front, because of India has been developing in its space program, it does have an indigenous missile program. But I'm guessing that the reason why India lacks a viable and healthy aviation sector is because it never really had the kind of drive or the individuals like Sarabhai in the aviation sector, and it's never took off. And consequently, not only in aviation, but in its military requirements, India is still reliant and paying heavily to meet its needs.
Okay.
Gurbir, what about the ground infrastructure to support all of this? Because, you know, we've talked about some of the missions. The ground infrastructure is as critical as the flight hardware and software. How's that structured?
Well, India being quite a big country, ISRO has tried to share out the activity right across India. And it has centres in the north, in Punjab, and in the borders of Bangladesh almost, and way down south in Kerala. I'll just mention just a few of the centres. Bangalore is where the headquarters is, and the headquarters is quite a large facility. It actually houses, in addition to the HQ, the facility for what's known as Antrix, which is the commercial arm through which Indian space program does deals with other countries who may want to have their spacecraft fly aboard a PSLV. Another bit was added only recently, a few weeks ago. The headquarters now also houses the Human Spaceflight Center, which will manage this new program. In addition to that, in Bangalore, there's also the satellite center, ISRO satellite center, where all the satellite components are and subsystems are brought together and integrated into a satellite and tested within Bangalore itself. There's also the tracking and command center in Bangalore. Space Applications Center is another area, another center based in the western part of India, in Ahmedabad, in Gujarat, state of Gujarat. And that's where one of the earliest applications that was run. In addition to these facilities, the actual hardware and physical facilities, there's a lot of application development that takes place, which uses the data that's collected by spacecraft and then distributed through these applications. And the Space Application Center is responsible for providing a lot of that. One of the earliest applications was the Satellite Instructional Television Experiment, or SITE, and that came out of Space Application Center. And it was an application which ran in 1975, which brought to some of the poorest people on the planet at that time satellite television, which most of us have at home now. But in 1975, they were the recipients. It was a scenario where you had one large TV, and I'm talking about a 28-inch CRT display, and would be surrounded by perhaps tens or hundreds of people who would be watching this. And the whole idea was to use an American satellite, the Application Technology Satellite 6, that was launched in about 1972. And for a whole year, India was given a loan of that satellite, and it transmitted educational programs for school kids and adults and agriculture, fishermen, farmers, to help to not only develop the economy in India and the education for the individuals, but also to demonstrate that this kind of technology, space technology, could be used to bring a level of progress for people in diverse and disparate environments. And of course, in such a big place like India, having a ground network of TV antennas, which is the other way to transmit this kind of information, is very difficult. It can only be done efficiently through space-based technology. And that was way back in 1975. And I'll just mention one other center. And this is now, it's called the Vikram Sarabhai Space Center. And it's an amalgamation of several sites way down in the bottom tip of India. And it now incorporates the very first launch site, which was called Thumba, from which the first rocket to go into space was launched on 21st of November, 1963. And that is a center now where a lot of the development work, not only for some of the engines and propellants, but also for spacecraft bodies. For example, the reusable launch vehicle was built entirely at the Vikram Sarabhai Space Center. But that's just a few of the centers, and there's many others throughout India.
From across the globe, from the center of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science, and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
It's really fascinating, and I think well told in the book, that story about the use of satellite TV, because in some ways, as I thought about it, it's the reason that India sort of leapfrogged a lot of nations into space, because they desperately needed that requirement, whereas others, as you quite rightly said, had ground infrastructure, TV, telecoms, telephones, and that sort of thing. And they overcome it using satellite technology. And it's a fascinating evolution to observe. Just before we move off of space infrastructure, I can't not let go of the use of the horse and cart to transfer. Can you just tell us that little story and why a horse and cart was used or cattle and cart were used to transport space satellites?
Yeah, so there is this picture of an open top wooden cart with rubber wheels with a satellite on top. Being dragged by a bullock with a few people surrounding it. It's only moving very slowly. And a lot of people do think that it's being used for transport. It's quite a natural conclusion to come to, because although this picture would have been taken sometime in the late 1970s, pictures from early 1960s showed the transport of rocket nose cones on bicycles, and that really was because that was the means of transport, very popular means of transport at the time. But this satellite on the bullock cart was the very first communication satellite that India launched. It was a free launch on the then experimental Ariane 3, and it was called the Ariane Passenger Payload Experiment. And it was the very first three-axis stabilized communication satellite, and it was launched by the Ariane launcher and then got up to GTO, and from GTO to geosynchronous orbit, they actually used a solid motor, which is not usual these days. Always use liquid motors for that stage, but the transfer from GTO to GSO was done with a solid motor, which was then being used for the fourth stage of the PSLV, or being developed for that. And it was pretty much successful. They had difficulty getting it precisely in orbit, but it operated for about 2 years and was highly successful. The reason why you see this satellite on a bullock cart is because in these early days, just like India's having this problem with human spaceflight training facilities, in those days, they just weren't the facilities for testing satellites. Nowadays, at the Israel Satellite Center, there's a thermal vacuum chamber and an anechoic chamber for testing radio transmissions. Well, they lacked many others, including a device for balancing for the earlier spin-stabilized satellites. But the kind of anechoic chamber facilities that are present today didn't exist then. So what they were doing with that particular bullock cart was moving that satellite with a bullock cart whilst testing its transmissions and reception. And the reason why the bullock cart was important is because there wasn't any electromagnetic interference.
So it's a great story, because reality is that's the best way to have done it with the resources they had. But let's leave the past there. Let's talk about what's going on now and the future. We've talked about manned flight, but India did have an astronaut, didn't it?
India had an astronaut in space, courtesy of the USSR Intercosmos program. The period of the 60s and 70s, particularly just after the Apollo missions, both the US and the USSR were quite keen to get ensure that they got put their foot in the door of other nations who were interested in getting into space. And one of the ways they did that was that Russia offered nations of several astronaut people from several nations to go into space aboard their rocket to their space station. Rakesh Sharma went up for about 8 days on Soyuz 7 in April 1984, and it was at the request, believe it or not, of Russia. It wasn't India who requested it. Indeed, it was Leonid Brezhnev, the Soviet premier, who approached India in 1978 initially, and the then Prime Minister of India, a guy called Morarji Desai, he looked at this request. He went to Israel and said, should we take this up? It's a free offer of an astronaut in Indian astronaut aboard a Russian space station. And Satish Dhawan, who was then the chairman of Israel, spoke to many other people and they said, well, no thanks, really. We can't do anything with that experience. It's, once we go up there, we'll come back down again where we've got to. And, of course, at that time, India was involved in developing its own INSAT program, the Indian National Satellites, which was the focus of its program. So, and this was the view that certainly Vikram Sarabhai had in those early days. So that spirit was still alive in at that time. And then 2 years later, there was a general election. Indira Gandhi was back in power, and Brezhnev approached her again, and she went to Israel, and Israel said no once again. So she went to the Indian Air Force, and they said, "Yep, yeah, we're in, count us in." And Rakesh Sharma was a test pilot for the Indian Air Force, and that's why the very first Indian astronaut was somebody from the Indian Air Force and not from Israel.
Okay. Given the timetable that they've got then, Kerbir, you know, we're talking 21, 22. Who have they got in training now, if anybody, and is that realistic?
Well, you know, it's a fascinating question right now.
Very diplomatic.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't put it against them, given some of the things that they've achieved so far. One of the things they have done is they've delivered on promises where they've made them. But this one, I don't know, we don't see much about Indian astronauts in training or anything.
You're dead absolutely right. You know, I said in 2007 they brought back to Earth something that they'd launched for the first time. They did so again in 2014, and that was a suborbital test. And they've also, last year, conducted a pad abort test. So they've been doing some testing with technologies associated with human spaceflight, but they haven't had the political commitment until August last year. I spoke to, there was quite a strong delegation from Israel at the IAC in Bremen in October. And I did speak to the then person in charge, a lovely lady called Lalitha Mbika. She was an engineer at Israel. She was given the responsibility for putting the management infrastructure in place soon after the Prime Minister made the announcement. And I had a chat with her along with some others in Bremen. And they're fairly confident that they've got technically they've got pretty much everything in place. What they lack is the astronaut training facilities, and that's why they signed a deal with Russia to help with that. And about 2 weeks ago, they made an announcement and unveiled the crew capsule, a mock-up, but a full-size crew capsule, only a couple of weeks ago. And they also announced that they've assigned a role for the Indian Air Force to identify and train 10 astronauts, and which means that they will be most likely be a test pilot criteria is being followed. And one of the things that I asked during my meetings with a couple of the people in Bremen was that, what are the chances the very first crew to go into space from India would be a woman? And the answer came back very loud and clear. It said, very high. And it was quite a surprise to me. But then again, you know, it really doesn't matter. It's not a big deal. But India is doing what the US and the USSR did way back in the 60s to get those headlines. Although I welcome this announcement, and the announcement is, incidentally, as you quite rightly point out, Peter, that by 2022, which is the 75th anniversary of Indian independence, to launch an Indian crew using an Indian launch vehicle from India into space for about a week in low Earth orbit. And they're looking currently at about a crew of three. Whether they can hit that target or not, it's not quite clear. They do plan two uncrewed flights in December next year and July 2021, with the plan of getting the actual first flight in December 2021, just ahead of the actual target date. But, you know, space flight is very challenging. It's very risky. But as we've seen with other achievements in India and indeed elsewhere, India was very successful with its Mars mission, its very first successful in Earth orbit space telescope, and very successful with that. PSLV has an incredibly successful track record. The GSLV Mark III has had two successful flights. That's a bit of an unknown for me. It's only two flights, and they do need this large GSLV Mark III launch vehicle to launch the heavy crew capsules that they'll need for this. But, you know, they do have a lot of testing facilities and simulations ahead of that. So I'm very optimistic, although, having said that, given the amount of money it's going to cost and the kind of practical payback you get from it, my personal view is that they shouldn't be doing this anyway, not just yet.
Interesting. Fascinating. I mean, the idea of a sort of a female astronaut. I mean, one of the I think India leads the world in female women airline pilots. Do you know if the capsule have a common adapter to be able to dock to the ISS? Is there any sort of idea of cooperation with kind of NASA or ESA to kind of be a ISS partner?
At this stage, and the answer is no. And this answer comes from a question that the ISRO chairman answered again at the IAC. The current go-ahead they've got is just for this single objective of getting the first crewed flight. And it's just too much of a short notice to change the configuration of the crew capsule they have at the moment. However, on the longer run, I'm expecting that India and hopefully China too will be working in a way that they can cooperate in the future. It's the only thing that makes sense.
And given that India doesn't have any heavy lift capability at the moment, how much further can it really push its exploration boundaries? I mean, it's gone to the Mars, Venus mission, possibly another mission back to the moon. How's it going to get around that heavy lift issue?
Well, that's been the major stumbling block. And in fact, had the GSLV Mark III mission not been successful last year, everything would have taken a hit, and certainly the human spaceflight program would have taken a back seat. One of the reasons why the Mars mission was such a small, only 15 kilogram total mass of the five instruments, was so small, and it needed to got to Mars with, I think it was about six Earth flybys first, was because of the launch vehicle, the PSLV. Despite the PSLV XL version, it just didn't have the oomph. You're quite right. The problem with or what India lacks right now is a heavy lift launch vehicle. Although, if you ask anybody in Israel, the GSLV Mark III is a heavy lift launch vehicle, because when it was first designed way back in the 1990s, it was a heavy lift launch vehicle because it has a capability of delivering about 4 ton to GSO. But compared to certainly Ariane 5 and soon 6, Falcon Heavy, SLS, it's way short of the target. Having said that, what India has shown is that it's adaptable. In the same way that it made use of the limited capacity for PSLV, I'm sure it'll achieve as much, it'll extract as much as it can out of the GSLV Mark III. And there is a what they call a launch vehicle Mark III, which will use a semi-cryogenic launch stages to enhance the liftoff launch capacity to GSO and indeed beyond. So it's still a difficulty for India as far as real heavy launch facility goes. But in time, it'll get there.
And given the Israel is predominantly government-driven and the world of space exploration, and you even mentioned China earlier and potential commercial space opportunities there. How's India facing the issue of generating revenue from its space program, and how can it compete in this evolving market where, you know, every day there's a new launcher of some shape or size that's appeared on the horizon?
Yeah, and there is a very small private sector, space private sector in India. It's not, although we don't know much about it at this point, but China has much more of an aggressive and flourishing private sector. I think that more will come out later this year. But in India's case, Israel has always made use of third parties, but the private sector in India, I have some contacts within some of the burgeoning space, private sector space companies, and one of the common features is that it's the Indian bureaucracy that still gets in the way. So there has to be some political changes, and I think they're on their way, but it's extremely slow. It's because Israel is seriously a government organization, although technically it's very competent. Administratively, it's a pain, and that's been a problem that's been reported by many people about the nature of the ability for private space sector to make some really good progress. I can only hope that Israel sees this and the government will change its process. There are elections due in India this year, and who knows, with even if there is no change of government, there might be some changes in policy, because it will really need to do that, if nothing else, to keep up with China, which has always been a motivation for India.
Yeah, I'll come back to that just a little later. Let's then talk about the book, The Indian Space Program, 6 years to research, 634 pages. I've got to say, I'm not saying it because you're a guest, I absolutely loved reading it. It's such a wide-ranging book. I learned so much about space that I just didn't know before, because it's not just about Indian space exploration. You go about explaining elements of orbital mechanics and launch dynamics and things like that. I learned a lot. Where did the inspiration for such an amazing and dedicated piece of work come from?
Well, thanks for the comments. I should say that the orbital dynamics and other technical details are in, I think it's about 9 appendices, so it's quite separate from the text. I suppose it's something that I've had an interest in and in space for quite a long time, and that coincided with the, if you like, the rise of India, certainly in the last decade or so. The space program has been growing quite steadily, but ever since particularly of Chandrayaan 1, and particularly the rise of social media, of all things, has highlighted what India's been doing in a way that wasn't available before social media. And that's why I think the success of Chandrayaan 1 was somewhat hidden. And since then, of course, India's been making many more strides. And as recently as last August, this announcement of the Human Spaceflight Program was just another one of those things that brought widespread attention to India. And I think also it's really what China's been doing. You know, last year, for the first time, as far as I'm aware, China launched most of the spacecraft into, if you compare all the launches in 2018, most of them, 39, came from China. That was ahead of US and Russia. And in whenever, just like we saw during the space race of the 1960s, whenever you have these two relatively close neighbors compete doing something, it's seen as a competition. And I'm pretty sure that the ongoing success of China will continue to motivate India.
Okay, so with such a large and involved project under your belt now, what are you working on next?
Well, the India book took about 6 years, and did about 3 research trips to India, visiting different parts of some of the centres that I mentioned. In fact, Sriharikota, where the launches take place, I visited that 3 times. The first time to watch a launch, but it was aborted, so I never got to see it. The second time I did get to see it, and the third time I actually had a walk around and a tour of the place. India is coming up, hopefully. It's been delayed so many times, but India's planning to launch its second moon mission, Chandrayaan 2. Should have been launched a long time ago, but currently it looks as if it's be either March or April this year. I'm looking forward to that. And there is another writing project I'm working on, which I'll announce in a few months. But it's I'm just so intrigued by what's going on, not just in India, but also in China and right around the world. There are now about 70-odd countries which have some element of a space program, and it's quite apart from what SpaceX is doing, the private sector here in the UK, you know, with Orbix and Virgin Galactic. There's just so much going on within the private sector. It's quite an exciting thing, and I'm sure there'll be plenty more to write about, but I'll tell you more about that another time when we speak.
Okay, yeah, it certainly is very, very exciting, everything that's going on. So tell us, Gerber, where can we find out about you, the book, the podcast, and whereabouts are you on social media?
Well, Twitter is my Twitter handle is Gurbir Singh, at Gurbir Singh, and most of the contact information is available on my podcast, which is available on astrotalkuk.org.
Okay, well, we'll take a quick break and then we'll come back for our wrap-up.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
Okay, just before we leave then, some shout-outs. Tim.
Ah, right, yes. Shoutouts. My shoutout would be for the Aero Challenge. It's the yearly kind of great egg race stroke quiz type Aero Challenge for young students, young graduates at Aero Society HQ in London. So if you are, if you listen to this and you are a student or a young graduate or just a young member, or you want to be a young member of the Aeronautical Society, 27th of Feb, at RSHQ, it's a fun sort of quiz skills type challenge, and you can go there with former team with other people from your university or your company. Get your company involved.
Okay, thanks very much for that, Tim. And of course, just to remind everyone that around the UK, but also all the aero societies around the world, there are free lectures. They are fantastic. They're well worth going to. So look up your local Royal Aeronautical Society. Certainly mine in the next few months. I think we've got three or four, one right after the other. So I'm going to see if I can toddle off to one of those on UAVs. So do look those up. Gerber, I noticed that you are doing a spring talk. Is it for the British Interplanetary Society on the 16th of March?
That's correct. It's on a Saturday. It's in Droitwich in Worcester. And it's free. And everybody's welcome. And I'll be talking about the relationship of the space programs between India and China.
Do you do many of those, Gerber?
Yeah, I've just turned out that I've been asked to come and speak, and I was at Manchester not so long ago, and I've got a couple more. In fact, they're all on my website, so it's astrotalkuk.org/events. It's an interesting time, as we were saying earlier. There's just so much going on. Yeah. And although I go out and do the speaking, I do find them these events a great learning, a source of learning as well.
Right. Well, I'll look up a few of those. I'll put links to all of those events in our show notes with this episode as well. Okay, that's about it then. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions, and of course to Gurbir Singh for joining us today. Thank you very much, Gurbir.
Thank you. Thank you, both of you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Yeah, it's been fascinating, absolutely fascinating. Cannot recommend that book enough. We'll put links to where you can buy that as well in the show notes. You can find Extended on all major podcast players, on the web, Twitter, and you can find us on Facebook as well. Come along and say hello. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, and please do ask before using anything you hear. This program is produced with a Creative Commons license. Okay, Tim, where can we find you online?
Okay, I'm at RES Tim R on Twitter, or you can find the Royal Aeronautical Society, www.aerosociety.com.
You can find Gareth, although he's not here. I do know he's pretty active on Twitter at the moment, Gareth_Stringer. And you can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and of course at XTP Media. That's it. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from our special guest, Gurbir Singh.
Goodbye, everyone.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Just as we hit the stop button on the recorder there, Gurbir offered to include some discount vouchers for his book, of course, the Indian Space Program. So I'll put links to those in the show notes.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media for their support in helping to present and produce the program.
Cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
But we do have a guest host. Gurbir Singh holds a bachelor in... Oh, man. I couldn't do it, could I?
BSc.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's one for the goofs. Yeah. That's one for the goofs, the outtakes.
We like outtakes, Gurbir. Unfortunately, I feature highly.
Oh, yes. I'm very familiar with them.
Right. 3, 2, 1.
One of the very earliest space applications was something called the Satellite Education Satellite Instructional.
SITE.
That's right. I'm very impressed with your professional approach here, Peter.
Trust me, Gurbir, there's a great deal to be done in the post-edit.
Extend it!
This is XTP Media.